Good morning and welcome to Jump in Tucson. I am your host, Dr. Ed Ackerley. You know, on Monday we talk about Wonder, where we celebrate the good things going on at the U of A, including student projects, learning, and student outcomes, as well as top-level performances by artists and athletes. Speaking of that, we have a Olympics going on. The 2024 Olympic Games are underway, and two of the most iconic symbols of this event are the Olympic rings logo and the music fanfare that you're listening to. With us this morning are two university experts to talk about how these icons are so recognizable as part of the Olympics. Our guests this morning are Brian Luce, who is a professor of music and associate director of the School of Music, and Karen Zimmerman, professor of art and associate director of School of Art at the University of Arizona. So good morning to you first, Karen. How are you?
Good morning, Ed. I'm good. Thank you.
Well, the Olympics is an iconic thing, and certainly logos and way that the visual presentation of what people see and hear during the Olympics is amazing, and certainly the logo and the music has been a big part of that. So, Karen, you're a professor of art and associate director at the School of Art at the University of Arizona. Can you tell us a little bit about your journey and how you got to the university?
Sure. Yes, I started working at the University of Arizona in the illustration, animation, and design program. And previous to that, I taught at the University of Hawaii in Manoa. I got into this kind of in a haphazard way. In my high school, I actually had print production and graphic design, and I went through that and then went to college at Rutgers. And then I worked in New York City as a designer for many years. But technology was changing, desktop publishing was coming in, Photoshop had just been invented, and I really was looking for a change in something more academic. I was really interested in the history of design, and that sort of started me on my journey and brought me here.
Great, great. So you know what logos, how they affect people, and the visual interpretation of a company or an organization is certainly presented graphically in many ways. And so we could do the experiment of showing, you know, somebody 10 different logos without the words of the company, and they could probably come up, the graphic symbol would emote some kind of emotion from them, and they would recognize that, and people would recognize who the company is or what the organization is. And so one of those iconic symbols is the Olympic rings logo that has been that is recognized around the world. Can you share a little history of those five rings and how they were introduced early in the 1900s?
Yeah, so the Olympic rings appeared for the first time in 1913 at the top of a letterhead, and it was colored in by hand with colored pencil by Pierre de Coubertin, who was one of the founders of what we consider the modern-day Olympic Games. Mm-hmm. He started the rings to talk about representing the five parts of the world that were won over by Olympism. And the five colors of the ring plus the white background of the flag was combined to represent every country's flag. So that was kind of where he started. And we learned what the Olympic symbols are because we've seen it our whole life. We see those iconic rings and the colors, and so it's instantly recognizable, similar to like a Nike swoosh, which we also like instantly recognize. But it's because we've seen it so many times and we've learned it. The way the five rings are arranged, our brain immediately connects us to that, to the games. The shape is distinct of the five combined. It's very high contrast. It works in color or monochromatically. It's a symbol of the Olympic Games.
Right, and it's not just that there's five circles there that are, that's the way they're intertwined with one another that kind of symbolizes the unity of the games and bringing the world together. It's even interesting, even in the 2024 Olympics, how there are some, obviously some countries that are competing that are maybe on the outside of the political landscape for many, many people would say, you know, the relationship with them, at least the U of A, USA's relationship with them is maybe a little tenuous right now. But yet when they come to the Olympics, everyone is together in the same court, same playing field, and they come together. And that's that intertwining of those circles is part of that representation.
Yeah, I think it's really important that the athletes and the public see the rings and the symbol and the Olympics as more than a competition, but it's also like inspiration, unity, respect. The athletes talk about how when they see those symbols, it signifies to them working together, making connections, inclusion, friendship, and integrity. So I think that's a really important part of what the symbol, people bring their own interpretation to the symbol, and that seems to be a consistent view of the athletes. And
yeah, we even have some examples of some teams, like say the men's and women's basketball team, where they're playing against each other in their professional sports, but they come and represent their countries and they all play together, and now they're teammates when maybe just a few weeks ago they were competing against each other. So it brings even the countries together within their own venue, which is neat. So from the days of the colored pencils filling in the circles, how has the logo changed over time, and do you see it changing over the next couple of decades? Will it be consistent?
I think the consistency is key to the recognition. So I don't see that the actual logo of the rings is going to change, and it hasn't changed a lot. There is a governing body that controls all of the Olympic assets, the IOC, the International Olympic Committee, graphic standards, and they kind of control how that is used. The three changes that I've seen, I found in 1957, there was a slight change in how the rings intersected. In 1986, there was a change in the visual presentation with a little gap in between where the rings overlapped. But then in 2010, it went back to the solid arrangement without a gap. So I don't see any, I personally don't think they're going to change it, because I think that's what makes it work.
Yeah, and it's been around for 100 years, so it's pretty iconic and so forth. Well, you're a teacher at the university, both you and Brian, and, as you teach young people who, obviously the Olympic dreams, people have the dream of going to the Olympics and getting a gold medal. Well, our students at the University of Arizona have an academic dream and a life goal. So what's the most rewarding thing for you as an instructor to work with young artists and so forth to teach them the things that they need to do to be successful?
That's a great question. I really enjoy the process of teaching myself, the preparing the materials and working with the students to teach them tools and processes to share their ideas and help them achieve those goals. I just love seeing them succeed, and it's extremely rewarding to see them succeed in classes and projects and assignments. But I'm really happy that I've kept in touch with many, and so I see them, their success beyond their academic career at the U of A, but how they've succeeded in their career. And it's so humbling and satisfying to see how they've become well-respected designers in the world. That's really a great part of the job.
Who knows, maybe one of them will come up with a new Olympic logo that, or some semblance of that, that is be recognized worldwide like the Nike Swish. So Karen, who is the, Karen Zimmerman, who is the associate director of the School of Fine Arts, the College of Fine Arts, the graphic design and so forth in the School of Art. Thank you for being here today and your interpretation. When we come back, we'll talk with Brian about the fanfare, the music that we hear at the Olympics when it's broadcast, and he'll talk to us about that. So you're listening to Jump in Tucson on KVOI 1030 AM, The Voice. We'll be back with the Wonder Series, celebrating the good things about the University of Arizona, and we'll talk to Brian Luce about how this iconic music dovetails with this iconic logo, the Olympic logo, and how those two work together to give an image and impression for people about the going for the gold. You're listening to Jump in Tucson on KVOI.
Welcome back to Jump in Tucson. This is Ed Ackerley. That very recognizable music is the Olympic fanfare. And our guest is Dr. Brian Luce, a professor of music and associate director at the School of Music at the University of Arizona. Before we talk about that Olympic fanfare, Brian, tell us a little bit about your journey and how you got to the University of Arizona.
Well, Ed, thank you very much for the invitation to join you, and greetings to everyone in Tucson. I actually have made a bit of a homecoming. I'm an Arizona native. I was born in Phoenix. I was raised in the ranchlands of the White Mountains. And it was music that actually brought me back to Arizona. Strangely enough, I bought an album of John Williams' music to Star Wars, I think in 1978. And that kind of set me on the course to becoming a musician. I've taught in universities in Pennsylvania, Illinois, Texas, and made my way back in 2004 to the University of Arizona. I'm a flute player by trade. So I've played orchestras. I've done a lot of marching band work. I have a music education degree. And strangely enough, I've known John Williams' music, not just by playing it in orchestras, but also because at some point in time, I made some arrangements and things like that for juvenile musicians to enjoy playing his music.
That's great. So John Williams is that iconic crafter of great music, such as you mentioned, the Star Wars, Indiana Jones, Harry Potter. And he debuted that Olympic fanfare theme in the Summer Olympic Games in Los Angeles in 1984. Why is that Olympic fanfare so iconic?
Well, I can tell you, I watched that opening ceremonies in 1984. I was in high school, and it was a really watershed event because everyone knew John Williams' music at that time because of those movies and various things. And that was the first time hearing his music outside of the theater, at least for someone like me who grew up in the hinterland, I suppose. And what was so amazing is that it capitalizes on all the vigorous articulation elements and the brass coloration that really kind of captivates the spirit of triumph. And fanfares have a history of that just goes back a very, very long way.
So why are musical fanfares in general, those iconic, whether it be, the U of A marching band plays Bear Down, or other bands play fanfares for sporting events, or we have the graduation march, or when the president of the United States enters an arena or a room, the Marine band plays a fanfare, and we have rituals and pageantry and the Olympics. So why are these fanfares so important for people?
Well, what's fascinating about fanfares is that they're all going to incorporate the basic harmonic structures that are created in brass instruments, all instruments for that matter of fact, but the fanfares are actually going to be from what we would call the first harmonic, the octave above the fundamental in the harmonic series, and its fifth. So that interval is going to play a calling card for any fanfare that exists, and it has for centuries, if not perhaps millennia. If we think back to the walls of Jericho playing on a shofar, that interval that's played most immediately on all brass instruments is a perfect fifth. And that is so ingrained in our human psyche and nature and auditory complex that we always stand up and take notice. It means something is about to take place. And in military bugle calls and in drum cadences and things like that, that interval is absolutely paramount because it has distinctive meanings for rallying the troops or ensuring a victory.
Is the fanfare music typically focused around brass instruments then?
Well, for the most part it is, because again, when we think about ram's horns or we think about any kind of brass instrument where you buzz, it always plays in the harmonic series of that, especially if there's no way of shortening or lengthening that brass tube, then it's going to play just within that harmonic series. And of course, the longer the tube, then the higher the harmonic series. But other instruments can easily play within that. If we go back to Turkish, what we call Janissary music or marching music at the time, they used the predecessors of oboes and English horns, as well as much percussion that added to their ability to signal across the troops. And that's what really fanfares, bugle calls, drum cadences, all those things were for rallying the troops, getting them in the right configuration for battle on the, whatever battlefront that might be, that are just historic in human nature.
And because those performances are outside, typically the fanfare needed to be loud enough to be heard. And so is that why brass is probably an important element, and drums perhaps, so that can be heard over a long distance?
Yes. I mean, actually, it creates what we call a trapezoidal wave, which busts apart the air molecules and creates this high report of sound that goes out. So that's why it's going to be more voluminous than playing a woodwind instrument like I do on the flute, which is a sine wave in its waveform. So they're going to be more impactful on the human ear, and it's going to travel and traverse a greater distance without running out of energy. But again, that interval of the fifth, when it's performed in tune, will reinforce itself and reinforce the sound wave. So we're always looking to try to reinforce reinforce and increase sound volume and sound propagation. And by the simple perfect intervals, and that the fifth is one of them, including the octave, that just really will carry a great distance.
We're talking we're talking with Dr. Brian Luce from the University of Arizona School of Music. So, and regarding the Olympic fanfare, will that change over time? Do you think that as time goes on and we go every 4 years with the Summer Olympics, for instance, will it still be relevant in 2064 as a march for the Olympics?
Well, what's so fascinating is I grew up with the Leo Arnault fanfare theme that came out in the 1960s Olympics. And it was, you heard it on ABC Wild World of Sports all the time. That was just so iconic. And that's what made the 1984 Olympics so impactful, is that all of a sudden we have a brand new fanfare that everyone was just absolutely attracted to. And of course it had, we all know, because John Williams is such a successful composer and really knows how to get to the heart of an emotional impact. And that's why I think that this one's going to stand the test of time for a bit. Now, will there be a young composer or someone else who brings something to the fore? I hope so. We always like to have new music to play. I'm a musician, and we don't necessarily always want to play the same old cover tunes, but we do. But I do think that at some point in time, with the changing of how our planet is shaping in geographical constraints, our political maps, all of those sorts of things, I'll bet there'll be a voice from maybe Africa or maybe South America or the Pacific Rim that might write a fanfare that will be catching our ear. And that'll just add to the repertoire that becomes the fabric that really intertwines us as human beings. And I'll bet it'll have perfect fifths in it, because it's just such a human hardwired mechanism in our auditory complex.
That's very interesting. You know, there are many athletes from the University of Arizona, several dozen, who are competing in the Olympics this
Bear down.
Summer Olympic. Yeah. And iconic people, swimmers and track and golf and men's basketball. Steve Kerr, the former U of A player, is the men's basketball coach. And so there are all of these athletes who are going, and they're, when that pageantry of the iconic sound of John Williams' fanfare happens, it's pretty powerful. And of course, when they get to stand on the podium, if they get to stand on the podium and hear the fanfare of their national anthem, it's a pretty powerful thing in their lives. But a question for you in regards to what you're doing with the students that you're teaching as a teacher. What's rewarding for you as a professor and a researcher and artist and performer as you work with young people who are trying to achieve their academic and life goals, much like these Olympic athletes are trying to do?
Well, this is such a timely discussion, because I'm in San Antonio, Texas right now at the National Flute Association Convention, and I have a whole gaggle of my alumni who are performers, teachers, entrepreneurs, people in the field. And the reward of knowing the people that I've had the privilege of working with and helping them towards those careers, manifest those careers in a multiplicity of ways, is just rewarding as anything I can imagine. And what's so funny about being a music teacher is that quite oftentimes, because I might have recruited someone into the University of Arizona School of Music, then they might meet someone in the school or marry someone. And those tendrils of connective human tissue through music, like it happens in athletics, all of a sudden you start to really expand your base of people that are so important to you. And it's teaching music is such a rewarding craft. I also coach youth sports, and it's the same feeling that you get knowing that you're helping another human being expand their horizons.
That's excellent. Well, we want to thank you, Dr. Brian Luce and Karen Zimmerman, for sharing your expertise about the iconic Olympic logo and fanfare. We'll be back after a word from our great sponsors, celebrating the good things happening at the University of Arizona. This is Monday Wonder on Jump In Tucson.
Welcome back to Jump In Tucson. This is the Wonder Series at the University of Arizona. I'm Dr. Ed Ackerley, and with us is Paul Tumarkin, who is Assistant Director for Marketing Communications for Tech Launch Arizona. Good morning.
Good morning.
So tell us a little bit about your journey, where you're from, and your background, and how you got to the University of Arizona.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome.
I grew up in Tucson. I went through high school as an Amphi Panther a long time ago. Went away to Colorado College, went to UC Irvine for grad school, came back after a stint in Chicago. It was just a couple of Chicago winters that convinced me that this was the place to be. And I've always had a passion for higher education and telling the mm-hmm. stories of higher education as a marketer. So that's a passion for me. I worked in technology and education. I worked for a startup up in Chicago and got my first taste of entrepreneurship and technology, which was really exciting. But when I came back in the late 90s, I was looking for a career in communications, specifically getting my start as a writer in marketing. And this was at the beginning of the years when we were just starting to talk about content mm-hmm. and what content meant on the internet.
Never can get enough content.
Right? But I worked for an agency. I worked for Pearson Education for a while. And then I went out on my own. And in that capacity, I did a little work for the university and ended up working for the marketing department at the university. And then when TechLaunch Arizona formed in 2012, they needed a marketing guy, and I got the job.
Great. Yeah. Well, U of A has a record number of innovations, inventions coming out of TechLaunch Arizona. TechLaunch Arizona is the U of A's office that commercializes inventions and from research and innovation. So can you just tell us a little bit about that process of what TechLaunch Arizona does and how you do that?
Yeah. So for our little over 10-year history, our focus has really been working with the faculty and the staff of the university to commercialize these inventions that come out of research. So the university has, we're coming up on almost $1 billion in research that happens every year. And so it's up to our office, TechLaunch Arizona, to work with those faculty members, those researchers, those innovators, to identify the inventions that are being generated by that funded research, and then protect that intellectual property and work to get it out into the world through licenses to existing startups or existing companies or to new startup companies mm-hmm. to take it out into the world where it can create a real-world impact for people. And those inventions can span any field that you can imagine. Anything that's being investigated at the University of Arizona comes across our desks. So it's physical sciences, it's engineering, it's life sciences, pharmaceuticals, therapeutics, software, content. It spans absolutely everything.
And so all across all departments, when research is being done in all the colleges and all the departments, then when something is unique and could be taken to market, then that's mm-hmm. when TechLaunch Arizona comes in and helps facilitate that process for faculty and so forth, who may not actually be, some of them, especially if they're a new professor, may not be well-versed in how do you take this and take it to market.
Yeah. We really want to make the process as smooth and as understandable and as easy as possible for everybody. It's complex, but we have a great staff of people. We have actually a team who are called licensing managers. And those are really interesting people because each one of them not only is experienced in the world of intellectual property and the legal side mm-hmm. of protecting inventions, but they're also technical experts. We have somebody who works specifically with the College of Medicine who is great with healthcare field innovations. We have somebody who works with the College of Pharmacy who is an expert in being able to talk to researchers about developing research in the field of pharmaceuticals. Same thing in the College of Engineering, same thing in the College of Science. And so these people form that bridge with the researchers to draw out the inventions from their research and then help take them forward.
We're speaking with Paul Tumarkin, who is the Assistant Director of Marketing Communication for TechLaunch Arizona. And, the university is on a fiscal year, so July 1 through June 30th. And so there was a notice that was sent out that there was a record number of inventions this year. So that's pretty exciting. What are the numbers we're talking about? What kind of numbers are more than we did last year or in previous years?
Yeah. So this past fiscal year, we received 307 new inventions from the university faculty and researcher community. That was up from 298 the previous year. And then actually the year before that we had done a little more in 303 in fiscal year 2022. So this was our record year. It was the most, we like to say, it was the most inventive year that the university has had in our history. And during that time, we launched 9 startup companies. We did 75 licenses and options for U of A inventions to companies out there. We filed 367 patents, and we actually had 78 new patents issued by the USPTO.
And you never know when one of those inventions is going to revolutionize the world, whether it be a backup sound, a radar when a bus backs up to
exactly.
frost gelato or whatever. Lots of things have come out of the University of Arizona. What is the faculty innovation program that is part of your impetus to try and stimulate some of these great ideas?
Yeah, so the university has an incredible research base and incredible level of talent across the entire university. With all that research going on, with all that talent in place, we know we have a lot of room to grow. And given the amount of research being done, we know that there's the potential for a lot more than 300 inventions a year out there. And that's the front end of the pipeline, okay? You have to fill the front end of the pipeline with all the inventions that you can, because like you said, you never know which ones are going to stick. You never know which ones are going to be the most successful at the beginning of the process. So you need as many as you can. So through this Faculty Innovation Ambassadors program, we've selected 8 of the colleges at the university, those that have the most active research pipelines and regularly have the greatest number of inventions. And we've picked a leading faculty member who has experience in commercialization and startups and commercializing their own innovations. And we have engaged these faculty members to be sources of information about innovation, invention, licensing, and startups for their colleagues and their students that they are regularly connecting with. And we're building events around these people. We're planning a series of events in the fall to introduce those ambassadors to their colleagues and let their colleagues know that, hey, you have a resource right there in your college that you can talk to about this stuff, who can help you through the process, who can give you tips and ideas to how to move through it. So they're really incredible people. We're really excited to engage with them.
And some of those have been through the process themselves and know what to expect and what they've had. And others you have brought through the process to show them what to do so they can be those ambassadors for those other faculty members or even students.
Yeah, they've all been through our process and we have great relationships with them. So it's exciting to be able to be bringing them to this new level of engagement.
So if you have a couple of hundred inventions and you know, in total, maybe about 400 or 500 things that you're doing each year with patents and so forth and inventions. Over time, then you develop this library of people who are familiar with what's going on and how to take the idea from conception to commercialization.
Very
so that's
much so.
A neat thing. And so this is called the Faculty Innovation Program, and that they're ambassadors, basically.
Yes, yes. We call them Faculty Innovation Ambassadors. Yes.
I love it. That's great.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, we're listening. You're listening to Jump in Tucson. This is Paul Tumarkin, who is the Assistant Director of Marketing and Communications for TechLaunch Arizona. And when we come back after the break, what we want to talk about is how TechLaunch Arizona can get younger people involved in coming up with ideas, but also fill that pipeline with important innovations and ideas and concepts that might eventually lead to some great invention that might change the world. You never know.
So, absolutely.
Yeah. Okay. Where is TechLaunch located? I asked that question off. I meant to ask it. Where are you located now?
Yeah, we're actually located in the refinery, which is the new building out at the Bridges. And it's a great new building. It's beautiful. It's a wonderful space.
Compared to the place that you used to be, which was kind of out in the dark, it's kind of nice to be out in the beautiful new Bridges landscape.
That's fantastic.
Great. Well, when we come back after the break, we'll continue to talk with Paul Tumarkin, Assistant Director of Marketing Communications for TechLaunch Arizona. This is KVOI 1030 AM, The Voice, Tucson's only live local news talk station, and you are listening to Jump in Tucson. Welcome back to Jump in Tucson. This is Dr. Ed Ackerley, and we continue with the Wonder Series, where we talk about the good things going on at the University of Arizona and exciting innovations and ideas that are going to market. One of the groups that does that is TechLaunch Arizona, and we're talking with Paul Tumarkin, who is Assistant Director of Marketing and Communication for TechLaunch Arizona. So welcome back.
Thank you.
So when we talk about scientific and engineering and medical and other kinds of inventions, that pipeline that you talked about is really important. You got to get things going through that pipeline. Can you describe the National Science Foundation Innovation Corps and how that ties in with this pipeline concept?
Yeah, so the pipeline that we have, all these innovations coming into TechLaunch Arizona, we can move that innovation along, but it really takes engagement from the inventors themselves to some degree. They have to be involved in the process. And especially when it comes to those inventors who are extra passionate and they want to develop startups. So we need to give those people experiences and tools and coaching and mentoring to help move them along. Mm-hmm. They are great scientists.
Right.
They are not always the best entrepreneurs in the world or business people.
Or marketers like you.
Yeah,
it's hard sometimes. You have a great idea, but if you don't tell people about it in the right way, you just have a good idea.
Exactly. And that's part of what iCORE is designed to do. It really helps to prepare these people to bridge that gap between academia and the business world. The iCORE program, it's an NSF program through the National Science Foundation, and it provides training and mentorship for researchers and entrepreneurs to help educate them. It provides some funding opportunities and grants to help support that innovation journey. It gives people this access to a big network of mentors and coaches who have been there and done that and brings them into their teams to help move their teams forward. And finally, it gives people help and experience with customer discovery, market validation, and just help all along the way with that technology commercialization process. We are part of a bigger hub. So the U of A is not isolated in this process. We are part of what's called the Desert and Pacific Hub. And so we are in this system with 10 other universities. We have cohorts of teams that move through once a month. So these entrepreneurial teams go through these it's a series of seminars, essentially. It happened once a week, and they go through four times over 4 weeks, and they learn all those skills and they develop that basic business plan. They develop an idea of who their market might be for this innovation. Mm-hmm. And it really helps them dial in their concept so that they can be successful, because often what they learn through the process is they start in one place and say, we've got a great invention. We know exactly who's going to want it and who's going to pay for it. And then they go through this class over these 4 weeks, and by the end, they've interviewed 20, 30, 40 customers, potential customers, and they learn, oh my goodness, the person I thought was going to be the buyer for this is totally different than who I thought it was at the beginning.
We were aiming at the medical field, and this is the space people that want to talk to us about this, and we were in the wrong target market.
Yeah. It's really interesting. Just a quick story about that. We actually, early on in my time at TLA, this was years ago, but we had an inventor who came to us from the College of Medicine. Mm-hmm. And he also had a lot of connection and experience in optical sciences. And they had developed a new kind of endoscope.
Mm.
And it was really cool because it not only saw forwards, but it saw forwards and backwards. So it provided a dual view that the previous state-of-the-art, previous kinds of endoscopes could not do.
Right.
And so they were looking at taking this out into the market, and they thought, this is going to sell. This is going to be great into the medical industry, and everyone's going to want one. And through their customer discovery process, what they learned is, yes, they had a long view to the medical industry, but their best first place to start was going to be companies that inspect the insides of jet engines.
Mm.
They would never have thought of that had they not gone through the process.
Right. And those mentors and those other universities and other people that are providing input say, hey, wish we would have had this when we were working on these projects. Could you put this over here in the jet engine aisle? So
yeah, and it's through that customer discovery where they make phone calls and do interviews and talk to people, and they just learn who their market might be.
That's excellent. Can you talk a little bit about how students get involved in this process through the Student Ventures Project?
So we have a new program. It's called Startup Wildcats, and it actually came to us just a few months ago. We merged with a group that used to be called Forge.
Forge, right.
Yeah. And so the Startup Wildcats is designed to help student entrepreneurs really get hands-on experience and coaching and develop a clear set of steps for them to move their own ideas forward. It's not academic. It is practical. It's mm-hmm. not curricular. They get hands-on experience. And so if a student, any student on campus, regardless of their academic focus, if they have an idea or an idea for a business, they can come to our student ventures group and join the Startup Wildcats. And we plug them into teams who can help boost their creativity, who can help them strategize, who can help them develop teams and relationships with mentors, who can help them move forward. It's new for TLA, but we have a great team who is focused solely on student ventures and helping them move forward.
You know, I'm over at the Eller College. I've been there almost, 3.5 decades, and you know, the entrepreneurship program over there is famous for coming up with great ideas, but I can see how this student ventures project and getting them the information infrastructure they need to take their great ideas and move it along is really mentors, basically, who have been there, done that, can help them focus their way through the process, because every student at the U of A probably has a great idea for something. How do you take that and move that along?
Yeah. And it's nice because it's really designed for any student, not just those students who are business students or Eller students.
So how is that process? How do you, if I had an idea for something really good, I obviously have to do a lot of work before I come to you, because it's got to be developed a little bit so that it has some viability before you get started. I just can't come up with some crazy idea and we'll walk in and say, can you take this to market for me? There's got to be some infrastructure there first. So how do you move the concept of obviously in a research situation, the faculty person's been researching for a long time and has a lot of passion and interest in that. A student might only be working on something for a couple of weeks and have a good idea. How do you take the concept from conceptualization to that commercialization process?
Well, for us, it would be a different process for each of those groups.
Right.
For a faculty member, we would work with them. We would have an ongoing relationship. So someone in our office works closely with them and works with them to understand their research, understand the nature of the inventions that they might be developing. When we have an invention that we think has potential, we report it. We assess the market for that invention. We look at the patent landscape and see where the opportunities might be to protect it. And then we work with them to decide if they want to license it to an existing company or whether they want to do a startup company. Both of those are viable pathways to bring something to market. We have an asset development fund, and this is a fund that we can use to advance those really early stage inventions. Often people come to us with ideas that just have an inkling of a future, and we need to figure out whether this thing has legs. So we can invest a little bit of money in it to develop the invention, to create a prototype, to move it along and see if it has potential out in the marketplace.
This is great. Great ideas that need some marketing and some support and some mentoring, and both for faculty and for students. And as I said, who knows? One of these great ideas might be the next best mousetrap, as they say, that no one ever thought would come, but it comes right out of the University of Arizona, and how amazing that is. Thank you, Paul, for coming in this morning and talking with us about Tech Launch Arizona. If you'd like to be interviewed on Jump in Tucson and share your success story, go to jumpintucson.com and let us know a little bit about you. And who knows, maybe you'll be live on the air just like Paul was this morning. Jump in Tucson is a great program. On Tuesday, you have Ted Maxwell hosting. On Wednesday, Grant Kruger will be here. And Tom Moulton will be here on Thursday. And I'll be back next Friday with business success stories. Jump in Tucson broadcast from the Bustos Media Stations and KVOI 1030 AM. Thank you for listening. Thank you, Paul, for being here this morning.
Thanks for having me.
Great. And thank you for listening. And we hope that you will jump in, Tucson.